Santerra versus UBS. Welcome back, Mr. Citron.
Nice to see you.
One second. I just did not cooperate. Okay, now we're ready. So same deal. You've got 8 minutes to start and 4 minutes rebuttal.
Sure. I think for purposes of this argument, I'm just going to focus on the one argument that really distinguishes Sterling, LIBOR, the Santerra case from Sullivan, your LIBOR case, and that's this contract issue about whether or not the OTC claims were assigned from fund liquidation, from front point to fund liquidation holdings. And our argument there is pretty simple. It's that this contract is not clearly directed to this question at all. It's sort of a mess. You can't really tell exactly what they're trying to accomplish with respect to this kind of claim, but there's every reason to believe that they did intend to assign it. They say they intended to assign it. There's lots of textual indications that they intended to assign it, and this is just not appropriate for resolution as a matter of law at the motion to dismiss stage. It just requires extrinsic evidence, and that extrinsic evidence is going to show that the intention of the parties was to assign these claims, and that's what contracts are for, right? They're just designed to execute on the intention of the parties, and the defendants are strangers to the contract. To point to the things that I think are clearest in creating at least ambiguity with respect to the contract, in paragraph 280, on JA 284, you'll find the operative language. It's in the definition of future claims. And one thing that it does is immediately after using the language that the defendants say is limited to claims under the 1933 and 1934 Securities Acts, it expressly excludes common law, state, and federal claims from the transfer. And that is a totally useless thing to point out.
I didn't hear you say totally what?
Totally useless thing to point out if you think that you've already limited it to claims, statutory claims, under the 33 and 34 Acts. Another, I think, extremely useful place to look is the notice of assignment, which is attached to the contract. It's JA 300. And there, what they say they're assigning is amounts payable in connection with any securities-related claims, right? That's what the parties are talking about. They are talking about assigning claims related to the securities that are being transferred, and they use securities not to refer to claims under the Securities Act in Section 19, the 33 and 34 Acts, but just all kinds of securities. And we know that from the contract because they defined securities to include things that aren't securities as a matter of U.S. law, and could never be the basis of a claim under the 33 and 34 Act. As we explained in the brief, U.S. law has a somewhat unusual definition of securities, because this is the tool that Congress has used to define where the jurisdiction changes from the SEC to the CFTC. But everywhere else around the world, securities is not limited to some very particular forms of financial contracts. It extends much more broadly to the kinds of claims we're talking about, or kind of financial transactions and claims we're talking about in this case. I think that's the main point of distinction between Santerra, between this case and the Sullivan case, Euribor. The other thing that's gonna come up in both cases is the antitrust standing issue.
Yeah.
I'll just say that this is what Platinum and Palladium is about. We have only had 350 words each to brief all the things that Platinum and Palladium affected in the case. If there is a question about the antitrust standing, it is also possible for the court to just send those issues back to the district court to analyze in the first instance. There's no jurisdictional requirement that the court reach these kind of alternative bases for affirmance.
But what about antitrust injuries, I guess, for at least the FX futures?
Yeah, they definitely have antitrust injury. They are complaining about the kind of, they have injuries, right, from the manipulation of the benchmark.
Well, I mean, why are they, I mean, I guess that's what I'm trying to figure out. How do we know whether they won or lost as a result of this manipulation? Just like gamma traders and other cases where that was a problem.
Yeah, for purposes of, it's really actual injury. It's really actual injury that we're talking about. That, I mean, you can call it part of an antitrust injury, but it's, were they hurt at all? Not, do they have the kind of injury, you know, for purposes of Bolamat. And there, I don't have anything to tell you besides what we have in our briefs. We have substantially less information about the Sterling conspiracy than we do, and how it moved rates.
Okay, but so how is this different than gamma traders, I guess, that I'm trying to figure out?
Sorry.
For purposes of injuries, I guess it's not clear to me why we know that you lost on these as opposed to won on these, your clients.
Right, we have only the allegations that we can muster from the information that we currently have. One of the distinguishing things here is that we have government exposure of the conspiracy. We know there was a conspiracy. And really what we're talking about now is the issue that, and Gelboim says, right, once you know that the conspiracy exists for purposes of Twombly, who was hurt and how is a matter that you can leave for the proof stage, and certainly for the post-discovery stage, right? We know there was an antitrust conspiracy. I can't tell you exactly how it moved the rates on every single day yet, but this is what I need discovery to figure out. And it's just asking me to do way too much at the complaint stage to allege more than that it did in fact injure us in our trading. You know, like
Total Gas lays out what you have to establish for an antitrust injury, and one of them is an actual injury to show that you were in a worse position as a result of this. And I'm not sure how you've done that.
Well, we allege
you don't need to do that at this stage.
We allege that we're in a worse position.
Okay, well,
right. But
how do you allege that?
Right, we don't have a.
I mean,
right.
Yes, it just seems like it's a conclusory assertion. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
It doesn't have evidence to go with it. It has, you know, only what we can say because of what we already know about the conspiracy. But we know there was a conspiracy. It manipulated the rates while we were trading. That is an injury. It is not one that, you know, would be measured in dollars, but it is exactly the thing the statute is trying to prevent us from being harmed by. And what we need is the proof stage to try to figure out
the
extent of that.
Then I guess Gamma got it wrong then, it seems to me. That should have been handled at the proof stage.
I think that's what Gelboim says with respect to situations where you know that there is a conspiracy, right? I don't think that extends to Gamma in the same way, but it certainly is
so
true.
So where there's a conspiracy, you don't have to prove an injury. You just get to that and discover.
But you never have to prove anything at the pleading stage.
For an antitrust injury, I mean, you have to establish, you have to plead some facts that are going to support an antitrust injury. You don't think you need to do that?
No, I think we need...
What you seem to be saying is all you need to do is plead a conspiracy, and that's the end.
I think that's not exactly... Maybe I'm overstating it. I think the language from Total Gas is actually quite instructive.
Yeah.
It tells us to look for... like allegations that the defendants are moving this market at a time that we are trading in it. And that we have. And we have plenty of evidence to go along with that allegation. Right?
Okay, this is Total Gas. The court must identify from these pleadings the actual injury the plaintiff alleges by looking to the ways in which the plaintiff claims it is in a worse position.
Right. It lists five different ways, right, that you can go about this. Depending on how close the connection is between the thing that the defendants were manipulating and your financial contracts, we have allegations that they are manipulating our financial contracts directly. As I said, we can't at this stage identify how much it moves it in one direction or another. We don't have extensive evidence about that. We have only what we can reasonably allege based on what we know. But you're asking, what you're going to do is shut almost every plaintiff in this kind of case out of court, because without any discovery, it's just difficult to know exactly how the rate was moving on any given day.
I'm literally quoting you from another case, and so I'm just asking you to tell me either why that doesn't apply or how you've pleaded facts that would meet that standard. And you seem to be saying you shouldn't have to do that, and you can't do that. It seems to be what you're saying.
Well, I'd like to check what the allegations are in the complaint with respect to this issue, but what I'm saying is we have set up a lot of evidence that the defendants are manipulating exactly what we're trading. And that's a lot for the
Gilmore's
pleading
stage. I mean, Gilmore's a one-directional manipulation. This is a, this goes up and down. This is two-directional, right?
Yes.
So that is what makes this different from that, and why I think you need to plead something to show an actual injury.
Yeah, as I said,
We'll hear back from you for 4 minutes. Now we will hear from Mr. Gottschalk.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. I think it's afternoon now. I may please the court. I'll actually try to work backwards. I'll start out with the questions that Judge Sullivan has been posing to my friend Mr. Citrin on gamma and total gas, antitrust injury, antitrust standing, actual injury, which also flows back into the CEA realm, obviously, as gamma was a CEA case. And then I'll try to work back to the contract issues, because I think they are very important as to the swap issue, which is which involves FrontPoint and now FLH. So the short answer is there is no injury. There's no actual injury. There's no antitrust injury. There's no CEA injury that's been alleged, full stop. It is like total gas. It is like gamma. So what we have here, you need to look closely at what was traded in this case. The futures that were traded by Mr. Dennis were traded on May 11th, 2010, according to the complaint. He opened a position. He took a long position, not in any futures contract that was indexed to or incorporated in or had baked into it sterling LIBOR. Not at all. His contracts were FX contracts. They were foreign exchange contracts. He was not betting on whether LIBOR was going up or down, which might be the case in the U.S. dollar realm with the CME euro dollar contracts that formerly traded, which were at issue, by the way, in the U.S. dollar MDL, which led to Schwab 1 and Schwab 2. He was betting on something different. He was betting on whether the pound sterling as a currency was going to be higher or lower expressed in U.S. dollars. So the futures contracts were, and this is pleaded in the complaint, they were settled on the basis of at delivery, you would get the U.S. dollar equivalent of 62,500 British pounds per futures contract. Again, nothing to do with sterling LIBOR. So he alleges on May 11th he opened a position. He doesn't say how many contracts he bought. He doesn't say at what price. He doesn't say during what time of day. Then he says 2 days later on May 13th, he sold and he lost $38,000. Full stop. That's all we know about his trading. What do we know about the manipulation that's alleged here? First of all, it's not manipulation of the FX markets. It's manipulation, allegedly, of LIBOR, sterling LIBOR. Sterling LIBOR is alleged to have some sort of an effect on the FX markets, but I can't for the life of me see what it is. It's very much like the Schwab 2 case in which and I think Judge Sullivan wrote this opinion, pointed out that as to the fixed rate bonds that do not reference LIBOR at all, Schwab had no antitrust standing. It was not an efficient enforcer. And the same is exactly true here. These contracts do not reference LIBOR at all. So in Schwab 2, what the plaintiffs tried to say is, well, we suffered these losses and they were sufficiently closely related to the misconduct, because what happened was some traders in the market, when they were deciding how to price fixed rate bonds, took into account the floating rate from LIBOR. Well, this court wrote in footnote 6, this is 22 F4th, page 118, Schwab's theory is that LIBOR exerted a kind of gravitational force influencing fixed rate bonds, but that is clearly insufficient to establish antitrust standing.
Sounds familiar, yeah, I get it. But
so there's no antitrust injury.
Do we even get to antitrust standing if they haven't alleged an antitrust injury?
Either one, Your Honor. There are two required steps for antitrust standing. One of them is efficient enforcer, which is what this Schwab goes to.
So in your view, where should we start?
You could start with where the district court started, or you can do it the other way around. The district court agreed with us on efficient enforcer.
Standing.
And that was actually something that was that really resonates, because this court decided the Leyden case after the district court had decided the case below. This case is on all fours with Layden. I'm not going to go through all the steps. In Layden, the court pointed out that was a Japanese yen case rather than a sterling case, but they were both LIBOR cases. And in each case, there were multiple steps between the alleged manipulation and the injury that the plaintiff claimed. In Layden, this court found that there were at least four steps. We count at least five. Again, it has to do with this idea of some traders somewhere in the market took into account sterling LIBOR in deciding what whether or not to buy FX futures. It's kind of a attenuated argument, to say the least. We're talking about many, many levels of ripple effects as opposed to somebody deciding to buy something that is in the very same market and is involves the very same commodity. I think the distinction between these cases, Layden and Schwab II and this case, Sterling, there's a complete distinction between all those three cases and the case that the plaintiffs rely upon, which is the platinum and palladium case. Now, platinum and palladium involved something quite different, and this court wrote exactly what the difference was at 61 F 4th at page 263. In that case, unlike this case, the defendants were alleged to have manipulated the very futures contracts that the plaintiff was buying. There's no such allegation here. The only allegation here, and it's a one-line conclusory allegation, is that the plaintiffs say that the defendants, among other things, were participants in the FX futures market. There's no attempt to connect it. There's no detail. It really doesn't even satisfy Twombly. But if you go back to the platinum and palladium case, this court wrote that the defendants not only traded the same futures contracts, they actually manipulated the futures contracts to profit from those transactions, while the exchange plaintiffs simultaneously lost money through futures contracts transactions in the same market. Therefore, the exchange plaintiffs were harmed at the first step. But if Mr. Dennis was harmed, it was at four or five or six steps away. This case is governed by Layden and Schwab too, not at all by Platinum. Now, I'd like to come back to the contract, because this is really, this has to do with the claim that was originally asserted by FrontPoint. There's no dispute here, it's conceded. FrontPoint ceased to exist. It dissolved itself under Delaware law. Sorry?
You're talking about the assignment?
Yes, the assignment, the alleged assignment. Judge Broderick found that the assignment was ineffective as to the antitrust claims, and that decision should be affirmed. So FrontPoint originally owned whatever claims it owned. It ceased to exist over 3 years before the APA, the asset purchase agreement, was entered into. And it ceased to exist before this lawsuit was commenced. So it's clear that FrontPoint has no standing, it has no capacity to sue, and the plaintiffs do not deny that. Their argument instead is that they're going to save and somehow revive these dead claims by saying that in 2012, this APA assigned those claims to Fund Liquidation Holdings. The APA was a New York law contract fully integrated between sophisticated parties represented by counsel, Delaware organized entities. FrontPoint was the seller, and FrontPoint was part of a major hedge fund family based in Greenwich, Connecticut, and they were selling contingent assets to FLH. The terms are clear and unambiguous. So you start with JA 282, section 1.1, which is where the assignment is made. And assigned to FrontPoint, FLH rather, are FrontPoint's right, title, and interest to what are defined as assets and defined as recovery rights. And when you go to those definitions at 283 and 285, you see that they include any right that FrontPoint had to receive money with respect to claims, which are defined as existing claims and also as future claims. Both of those terms are defined. The key term here is future claims at JA 284. Those claims are defined as claims to recovery rights, quote, arising out of any future securities class action lawsuit or any judgment thereon to the extent related to seller's ownership of or transaction in any included securities. I will spot Mr. Citra on the second point. Let's assume that these swaps are included securities. And by the way, they are securities because they are security-based swaps, and the
federal security statutes were amended by the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010 so that a securities-based swap is indeed a security. I would call the court's attention to 15 U.S. Code section 78C sub A sub 68 cap A.
I'm not sure where we're going there. The issue is whether or not, it seems to me, securities class action is unambiguous.
Yes.
And so you're saying that because they're sophisticated and because there are a lot of laws and regulations, everybody knew what that meant.
Well, yes. So the argument...
So clear. I have to say that's not so clear to me.
Yes, it's very clear that the idea that the plaintiffs are trying to propound and rely upon is that somehow the term securities class action lawsuits is some sort of an arcane term of art that only judges and lawyers know. That's not true. If you're in the securities industry, you're charged with knowing that. And it's not true either that Judge Broderick said they were limited to federal claims under the 33 and 34 Act, because what he said was in the federal context, those were the kinds of claims that are securities class action lawsuits. However, in plaintiffs' papers, and again today, plaintiffs have elided and taken those words out to make it seem like Judge Broderick was interpreting this more narrowly than he should have. As for the exclusions, so the plaintiffs are saying, well, before I get to the exclusions, the problem the plaintiffs have, and I think it's an insuperable problem, is there is simply no provision in this APA that assigned antitrust claims. What the plaintiffs essentially need to do is to delete the word securities and have this read any class action.
What if an antitrust claim is securities related?
Well, if an antitrust claim may be related to securities in the sense that securities are the underlying instruments or products, that's possible. But what this is talking about is the nature of the claim. A securities class action is defined by, is it a claim for an alleged violation of some securities law? It could be a state securities law. It could be the 33 Act. It could be the 34 Act. So, but the issue is the nature, the type of the claim, rather than the underlying instrument. And there's no world in which an antitrust claim is a securities class action lawsuit. And not only that, the APA does not even use the word antitrust once. Now, what the plaintiffs would like to do here is to turn this into a different kind of APA, and this court faced this in a case involving SIBOR, the Singapore interbank offered rate. So in the SIBOR case, which was called FLH against Bank of America, 991 F3rd 370, at footnote 15, this court noted something, and it didn't have to decide it, and it didn't decide it, but it noted that there were two different types of APAs in front of the district court in that case. One of them was the very same APA we have here, which is the Front Point APA. There was also an APA involving the Sonterra entities, which also conveyed certain types of claims to FLH. And what this court did was it noted, and without disapproving, that the district court in that case made reference to this limitation that appeared in the Front Point APA, which limited it to securities class action, whereas the Sonterra one didn't have that limitation. And Judge Hellerstein in that case ruled, just as Judge Broderick did in this case, that the Front Point FLH APA did not convey antitrust claims. Now, what the plaintiffs would like this court to do is to rewrite the agreement so it reads like the Sonterra agreement. But that's not the function of this court. You've got a clear and unambiguous contract under New York law with sophisticated parties. There's no reason to do anything other than to leave them where they were. And the answer then is that Judge Broderick got it right. There is no effective assignment of the antitrust claims, and it was proper to deny substitution to FLH. And so for those reasons and the others in our brief, we request that the judgment below be affirmed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gottrich. And then Mr. Rakowski.
May it please the court, Seth Rakowski for UBS. This court should affirm for the reasons set forth in the defendant's joint brief and argued today by Mr. Gottrich. But in the unlikely event the court disagrees, the claims against UBS should remain dismissed for the reasons set forth in UBS's cross-appeal. The only reason the district court allowed claims to proceed against UBS was because of a misreading of UBS's regulatory settlements, which make clear that any alleged conduct relating to Sterling LIBOR concerned intrabank conduct by people operating overseas, allegedly to benefit certain trading positions by moving sterling LIBOR up or down in discrete instances. Plaintiffs mischaracterized those settlements by seeking to conflate alleged conduct relating to entirely different conspiracies, entirely different benchmark rates, with conduct relating to sterling LIBOR. And their complaint alleges no facts showing that the alleged conduct actually injured Front Point. Plaintiffs, therefore, have failed not only to state a plausible claim against UBS, but also to demonstrate that the district court had personal jurisdiction for their claims. Unless the court has questions, we'll rest on our briefs.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Citron, back to you for 4 minutes.
Sure. With the court's indulgence, I think what I would like to do is beat a strategic retreat on the question that we were debating earlier, and just point out that what's going on here in Sterling is a little bit of a procedural challenge and difference. The district court rejected these claims with prejudice because it thought that there was no personal jurisdiction. That was the sole basis on which it ruled. It did not hold that there was any kind of Twombly problem, that we had underpleaded our allegations of injury, for example. If it had, the ordinary thing that you would be entitled to do, because Twombly dismissals are pleading errors, is to amend the complaint and add those allegations. I'm going to agree that the allegations in the complaint, as presently stated, are too bare to show antitrust injury with respect to the futures claims that we were talking about. Mr. Dennis, I think we should have an opportunity to amend the complaint to address these kinds of pleading deficiencies. And if we can't specify anything more concrete about our injury, we will have a problem. Even Gamma, the cases we were debating, they're all after this complaint was dismissed.
I get that.
You know, so really what all we're talking about is a personal jurisdiction issue here and the district court's kind of strange holding that even though UBS's claim contract is a direct sale into the United States, you don't have antitrust standing to sue the other defendants, which is just like contrary to the way the joint and several liability for antitrust conspiracies has always worked. And so, you know, those two things are the only things the court has to reach. And then I think it can acknowledge that there are shortcomings in the pleadings for purposes of injury.
But what about the assignment?
Oh, yes, you'll have to reach the assignment question as well.
Yeah.
And with respect to the assignment, I'll just say we're not saying that it's an arcane term of art. We're just saying that the contract is not very clear on this particular question.
It's not very clear as to whether securities class actions include antitrust class actions.
That's right, exactly. Because what it says elsewhere is that it's trying to convey all the securities-related claims. And as Judge Jacobs pointed out, you can have antitrust claims that are related to securities, which I think is what they were intending to convey, especially based on that language from the notice of assignment that I read earlier. And just to point out, you know, the Sonterra contract was so clear that it assigned these claims as a matter of law at the pleading stage. There wasn't even an argument that they weren't assigned. What we're debating here is whether this contract is so clear the other way that it was appropriate for the district court to resolve it without looking at any extrinsic evidence. I think the contract is sufficiently unclear that we are entitled to get past the pleading motion to dismiss matter of law.
So you're going to have extrinsic evidence and you're going to sort of figure that out? That's what you're going to say? There's going to be evidence developed, testimony perhaps, experts even, and then the district court is going to conclude from that whether or not the what the assignment means?
Well, I mean, there's New York law.
That's perfectly permissible. Is that what you're asking?
There's New York law that stands for the proposition that you should follow the current stated intent of the parties with respect to the contract if it's the same, even if it's not consistent with the language of the contract. All we're saying is we would do what the evidence suggests was the intent of the parties.
The contract are now aligned with respect to the fact that they want to litigate this? The court has to oblige them?
One of the entities doesn't exist, so we would be using a representative to testify about what the intent of the parties was at the time of the transaction. The district court could take evidence on that, or the jury could hear evidence on that and say, this is just not credible, right? You could say, we don't believe what you're saying, but it's competent evidence of the intent of the parties. The intent of the parties is what controls. It's just a contract. And if the contract is not clear, then we have to take evidence on what the intention of the parties is.
All
Could I just ask you about the first point you made about amending the complaint? Is that something you asked the district court?
I think that it is, but I'm not sure. I can't tell you for certain. I think we wouldn't have asked for it with respect to the bases on which the district court actually dismissed, right? So if it had found pleading deficiencies, we would have had the opportunity to say, okay, give us the opportunity to replead. And that is the ordinary relief when you have a Twombly problem, is an opportunity to bulk up whatever allegations are viewed as too thin. We just haven't had that here because a very long time ago, the district court dismissed on personal jurisdiction grounds that I don't think are defensible any longer.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Very much appreciate the court's time.
Helpful. We will reserve decision. That concludes all.